All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am breaking down the Falcons' safety position, talking about the battles and storylines involved at this position group heading into training camp.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the internet, and, of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. You can find me on Twitter, at FalcFans. Today, we're talking about the safety group. We're almost done. We got one more position to do before we get you guys prepped for training camp. This has been a month-long process in the making, and I appreciate you guys checking us out, trying to pump out this content during this dead time of the summer when nothing is going on. So I appreciate everybody giving me the listens and spreading the word and doing all those sorts of things. So this safety group is an interesting group. I will talk quite a bit towards the end about Keanu Neal and why he's the greatest and why, you know, the things that the Falcons need to do from a overall defensive standpoint to get to the next level. But first we'll start talking about at least the back end of the roster and the depth positions in terms of guys competing for roles. You're looking at a bunch of guys that really are fighting for a practice squad spot now that the Falcons picked up Ron Parker, and he seemingly are going to be set with the four safeties and Parker, Casey being the backups to Ricardo Allen and Keanu Neal. But, you know, prior to that addition, there was an expectation in that one of these other guys, you know, whether it was going to be Tyson Graham, particularly at that strong safety spot, or Cedric Cooper, or Jason Hall, or whoever, Marcellus Branch, would have an opportunity to make a roster spot. And, you know, of that group, I like Tyson Graham the most out of that group. You know, I think the other guys do bring something to the table, and we'll see what they bring. You know, I think Jason Hall, you know, showed he was a hitter at Texas. I think Cooper and Branch can both dabble, have the versatility to play both free safety and strong safety. You have Chris Lammons, the undrafted free agent, who's more of a free safety, but is sort of in that same mold as Allen and Casey and some of these guys that we've had who are corners or nickel corners turn free safety in this role. And you know, you can make the case that he's the best of this group, but just because of the abundance of free safeties with Allen, Casey, and now Parker, who's going to play primarily as a backup strong safety, but in the past was a free safety, do you need another guy in that role? And I think it's important for hopefully one of these guys, not only at this position, but other positions, to really sort of step up and potentially solidify a spot for on the practice squad. Since you have both Allen and Parker on the verge of hitting free agency after the season, your chances are pretty good that you're going to lose at least one of those guys, which is going to create an opportunity as far as your depth goes, where you can sort of move one guy up from the practice squad in 2018, potentially be that fourth safety in 2019. And that means that's one less asset, that's one less resource that you have to devote this next offseason to sort of supplement your roster. And that's, you know, somewhat a justification I have for making as big a deal about these third string roster battles as I often do. The other, you know, justification is I'm just crazy. But it's like we've talked about this in the past where given some of the, you know, limitations that the Falcons are going to have over the next couple of off seasons in terms of their cap space and the fact that they're not necessarily going to be loaded with draft picks, you know, although they probably will get a couple from compensatory picks over the next couple of years. I think they're slated to get two next year based off of the projections. But, you know, they're not going to basically have, you would assume they're not going to have like 10 draft picks every year like, you know, the Browns or some of these other teams tend to have that are at the bottom of the league. And so because you don't have as many resources to devote to upgrading your roster, if you can develop this pipeline, particularly from the practice squad to the roster, that's going to be, you know, something that can help you out, not necessarily solve all your problems, but it'll take pressure off of the other issues that you may face. And this goes back to something I've said in the past about, you know, whether this coaching staff is as good at developing talent as they often get credited for. And I think, you know, that's one example where you don't see that many current contributors that started out on the practice squad. You know, where are the Harvey Dahls? Where are the Brent Grimes from, you know, yesteryear, those guys that went from the practice squad to being what eventually starters? You know, I think you look at this current roster and you look at the guys that are slated to contribute this year, basically it's Ben Garland and Marvin Hall, who spent like a month on the practice squad last year, are really the only guys that are former practice squad players that you can really count on contributing this year. Well, you know, I guess we'll see, maybe that changes after training camp this year. Now, that being said, to be fair, you know, I would make the argument that in the cases of Brent Grimes and Harvey Dahl, the reasons why they were able to, you know, fast track their development had less to do with, you know, the coaching staffs of Bobby Petrino or Jim Mora, and more to do with NFL Europe. But part of the issue is, without a developmental league that the NFL doesn't currently have, maybe we'll see something on the horizon in the future, and due to the limitations that they have with practices now, where you can't practice, you know, you can't hit as much as and whatnot, it's a little bit harder in today's NFL to develop some of these young players, I think, than it was, you know, 5-10 years ago. And so even though I might criticize them for not necessarily developing guys at the rate that they often get credited, you do have to admit that the deck is somewhat stacked against them for the reasons I just outlined. So I think, you know, in the specific case, when we talk about the safety group, you're talking about a guy like Marcellus Branch, who spent last year on the practice squad, or in other guys across the roster like Daniel Brunskill, JT Jones, or Reggie Davis, et cetera, that were, you know, or holdovers from the practice squad. Can any of those guys carve out depth roles? That's something I'm going to be eager to see if we see that. And that may mean, like, you know, there's one less sixth round pick or something like that that the Falcons have to use to address that roster spot, because one of these guys can potentially fill it. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why we make a big deal about, you know, losing Jermaine Grace among other players and whatnot. And so, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, I tell myself, why I get invested in these roster battles and why I'm paying attention in the second halves of these preseason games. And maybe that will help you guys not fall asleep in some of these, you know, third and fourth quarters of some of these preseason games. And with the idea, like, okay, if some of these guys step up, maybe not necessarily they're going to contribute in 2018, but they have the potential at least to contribute in 2019 or beyond. So that's something to keep an eye on. And in the, I think the safety group, you know, we could see a little bit of that potentially. We'll talk a little bit more about the depth at the safety position as well as Ricardo Allen in a bit. But I do want to plug LockedOnSports.com, your one-stop hub for the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find content related to the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, and fantasy sports. Again, LockedOnSports.com, your team every day. So I think, you know, looking at the Falcons' depth, you know, I think the addition of Ron Parker, as I mentioned before, was a big one. He's a very versatile player, has experience playing outside corner, slot corner, free safety, strong safety throughout his NFL career. I think the Falcons, I imagine sort of the Falcons, obviously for having a competent backup behind Keanu Neal. But I think, you know, I can imagine that the Falcons may try to use him more as a guy that can cover tight ends and take pressure off Neal to basically hold those duties, is sort of where I think Parker's potential impact could be, and does give them a strong option and strengthens their ability to play some of those three safety looks this year that they've dabbled at various times over the last couple of years, but I don't think have played, maximized that to the potential that they could now that they have Parker. And I think one of the fun things about the secondary is that you can pick the eight players, put the eight guys in the bag, the four safeties, Trufant, Oliver, Alford, Poole, the four safeties, Allen, Neal, Parker, and Casey. And you can put them in a bag and you can pick five or six out of them out of that bag and be pretty good. Well, no, let's be fair. The first three names you have to take if you're playing this game, it's got to be Trufant, Alford, and Neal. Then if you're picking two or three more names, you can take the other five guys, put them in a bag, and basically pick out any combination, and you would find yourself with a pretty solid starting caliber, very good, potentially secondary, regardless of sort of how you mix and match that group. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons you like the depth of the Falcons secondary, because the addition of Parker enhances, as I said. You know, prior to that, I was a little skeptical of, like, why did they let Sherrod Neesman go to go with an unproven player when the best case scenario of that guy is probably only going to be as good as Sherrod Neesman, so it's a lateral move. And given, you know, the injury-prone nature of the safety position, as I've explained in previous podcasts, where you have guys that are 195 pounds or 200 pounds or 210 pounds running full speed into 220-pound running backs or 250-pound tight ends, the nature of the position sort of is not biomechanically speaking is not conducive for your long-term health. And so I think it was very important for the Falcons to add a player like Parker, given, you know, how physical Keanu Neal plays. And the one question I had about Keanu Neal when we drafted him, or the two questions I had about, is how good is he in man coverage, because he never got to play there at Florida. And given his playing style, is he going to have the same issues that Willie Moe had, which is he's going to wear down because he wasn't as big as Willie Moe is. And, you know, his playing style, very physical, means that he can be a little bit more prone to injury than, say, you know, someone like a Ricardo Allen, who's not going to necessarily be flying around decking guys over the middle every single snap. And so, you know, let's talk more about the Falcons safety depth with DeMonte Casey. I think this is going to be a very important summer for him. I think because it could really determine the outcome of the next couple of years here in Atlanta. And maybe that's as a starting free safety. Maybe that's as a third safety. You know, I think it could have very real implications to what the Falcons decide to do with Ricardo Allen's next contract, which we'll talk about later. I think, you know, he'll be competing with Parker for that third safety spot. Obviously, I think the Falcons want to see Casey sort of rise up in that, as it were. To take over that spot and be that third safety, but having a guy like Parker means that if Casey isn't quite there, then they don't necessarily, you know, it's fine as well. He's an insurance policy. And I think, you know, the main thing that Casey needs to work on, I think he's got the physicality, I think he's got the speed, I think he's got the range. It's really the instinctual aspect of the game. And it's not, don't get me wrong, I think his instincts are good. But I think his instincts when he was playing cornerback at San Diego State was honed more to, you know, playing in that quarters coverage and dealing more with stuff closer to the line of scrimmage. And it's very different from the instincts that you need to hone when you're playing that deep middle, that center field role that the Falcons have with their free safety, often in their cover one and cover three looks. And I think you saw flashes of that last summer particularly. I think once we got to the regular season and he started getting a little bit more extensive action, particularly early in the season, it was clear to me that the Falcons coaching staff didn't completely trust him, particularly, I think it was the Detroit game where Allen got knocked out of the game and he came in, and pretty much for like the last quarter of that game, the Falcons were almost exclusively in cover two because they didn't trust Casey to be, you know, the deep center fielder. And then the following week he was given more of those deep center field responsibilities. But I do remember at a certain point late in the game, they started playing him closer to the line of scrimmage and asking him to cover LeSean McCoy out of the backfield, and that seemed something, you know, at least the film suggested that he was a little bit more comfortable with that because it was more akin to what he was doing at San Diego State. And so one of the big questions will be, as it is the case with him and as well as several other players in that 2017 draft class, like a Duke Riley, is the game going to really start to slow down for him? And that's going to be the big question. And I think determining how much growth he has over the course of this summer, I think, is going to be one of the things I'm going to be particularly focused on, because I think, again, it has implications for how the Falcons deal with the Ricardo Allen contract situation. You know, the only concern I have there when it comes to Casey really is they don't have all 22 for the preseason games, so it's kind of hard to see everything that the safeties are doing. So it really, you know, it might be a situation where without some good angles from the television when they show, you know, those backfield angles where you can usually see the safeties, you know, we may have to wait till September to really see what Casey is really capable of. At least I will. And I think, you know, going back to Allen's contract situation, I think I'll be curious to see how the Falcons handle that as well. You know, Von McClure of ESPN basically said, I think last month, that the Falcons were planning on giving him a contract before the season started. And Von is usually on top of these sorts of things, so there's no real reason for me to doubt that at this point. But I do think, you know, speculating, I think the Falcons have three real options and three choices that they could make when it comes to Ricardo Allen and how they handle his contract situation. And I think they'll be justified choosing any of these three. I think the first one, they can do exactly what Von says and get a deal done sooner rather than later before the season starts, and pay him whatever they think he's worth. And that's just one less issue that the Falcons are going to have to worry about in 2019. And then they can devote their resources to filling other issues, given that, you know, Ricardo Allen is solid. The second thing is that they can maybe wait a couple of weeks going into the regular season and wait till mid-season, similar to what they did with Alfred and Schrader back in 2016, and, you know, see maybe if there's some injury issues that pop up. Maybe see where KZ is. See what Parker is contributing to. You know, all those sorts of things that will, you know, potentially have an effect on how well Allen and other safeties play this year that could then affect, you know, how much leverage one party has versus the other in the negotiations, and maybe give the Falcons a little bit more leverage to potentially, you know, come out with a more team-friendly contract or something like that. I think the other the third option is that they could basically just hold off and punt until wait till after the seasons, see how the whole season plays out, see what sort of leverage they can gain based off of the entire season, and see, you know, what their cap situation exactly is like, rather than just guessing, you know, looking at how many other holes that they may have to address, you know, next offseason. And potentially as well as wait and see maybe if next year's safety market and free agency is deflated to the same level that it was this past year, and maybe they can get Allen on a team-friendly deal. All of those are viable options for the Falcons. I think any of those three makes sense from the team's perspective. You know, I think I would like to see them get a deal done with Allen. You know, when that happens, how that happens doesn't really matter too much to me, as long as, you know, the end result is what really matters. You know, they can justify, you know, the ends justify the means in that case. My hope with the Allen contract, if they do decide to do it, is that it's basically like a 2-year deal where, you know, whatever his guaranteed money up front is basically what he gets paid out over the first 2 years. My estimation based off of other contracts is that will somewhere be in the $12 million to $15 million range. Based off of his position group. And, you know, I think that's basically, you know, the Falcons basically gave Mohamed Sanu a 2-year, $14 million deal. He's now entering the third year of that. But, like, I don't understand, for the life of me, I couldn't understand why someone thinks Mohamed Sanu is worth that that money and Ricardo Allen really isn't. So that's how I sort of feel about it. I'm definitely a pro-Rico guy, have been so since 2015. You know, I still hear complaints about him. I still, you know, the most common one being is he doesn't create enough turnovers. He doesn't get enough interceptions, which is basically, at least my interpretation of it, is code for he's not Earl Thomas, i.e. he's not, you know, a potentially and likely first ballot Hall of Fame safety, you know. But it's funny because it's like when you go back the 3 years that Dan Quinn has been here, no player on the roster has more interceptions than Ricardo Allen does. With 6, you know, Deion Jones is tied for that lead with 6. Alfred has 5. Trufant has 4. So, you know, you certainly could look around the league and be like, yeah, there are other safeties that create a lot more turnovers than Ricardo Allen does in that span. But I don't know if it's completely fair to sort of single out Ricardo Allen. He doesn't get enough interceptions when he's, you know, doing as good, if not a better job than pretty much everybody else on the team. And I think, you know, especially when you factor in the fact that his job isn't necessarily to create turnovers, is to prevent big plays. That's really what his job is. And I think, you know, I think that's something that he could certainly improve upon. And certainly think he can maybe, particularly if he trusts his teammates to do their jobs a little bit better, particularly now that some of these, you know, that 2016 draft class is now entering year 3 and they should be, you know, any rookie mistakes should be things of the past for those guys. I think maybe then that could allow him to be a little bit more aggressive and gamble, similar to what you see with Earl Thomas. Like I recently rewatched the Houston Texans Seahawks game from last year. And in that game, Earl Thomas had a pick 6. And in that game, Earl Thomas, the Seahawks showed cover 2 initially. And, you know, Watson saw that, Deshaun Watson. And like you saw, he thought they were in cover 2. He made a throw to DeAndre Hopkins on a crossing route over the middle, but because the outside receiver was a tight end, and KJ Wright, and basically Earl Thomas was like, I don't need to give KJ Wright deep help against some bum tight end. No offense to whoever that tight end was. And so basically he was like, okay, if Hopkins does this crossing route, I'm going to read Watson's eyes and I'm going to jump it. And he did. And so that when you watch Seahawks film, and the point is like when you watch Seahawks film, one of the great things about Earl Thomas and why he is Earl Thomas is that because of his instincts and his abilities, like he will cheat all the time. Like if they're showing cover 2, that doesn't mean that they're going to play cover 2. Like that's the thing that you'll notice with Earl Thomas the more film you watch of the Seahawks. And, you know, Is it a bad thing that Ricardo Allen is not that dude? Like, no, it's not a bad thing. Maybe we can see him be more willing to take those chances because he trusts his guys, like, you know, Earl Thomas seemingly did. Like, oh yeah, KJ White is going to do fine against this tight end. I don't need to help him out. But again, yeah, I can't fault a guy for doing his job, even if he may not do it as well as other people do. So, you know, I can get why people want a safety that can play a little bit more fast and loose on the back end, take more chances, maybe gamble a little bit more, and create more opportunities for this defense, particularly with the turnovers. I don't quite agree that some people say that it's like the missing element that's preventing this defense from reaching the heights that it's capable of. I personally think that missing element is the pass rush, and I'll explain that a bit further when we talk about Keanu Neal in a bit. But I do want to plug Locked On Hawks with host Brad Rowland on the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network. You can check out Locked On Hawks as well as a whole host of NBA shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So before we get to the pass rush and how that sort of affects the potential of this defense, let's talk about how amazing Keanu Neal is. And I'm going to talk about this in the sense of, I'm going to say my thesis is that Keanu Neal does not get nearly the credit that he deserves. And I'm going to juxtapose that a little bit with Deion Jones perhaps getting more credit than he necessarily deserves. But, you know, I will – don't interpret this as me criticizing Deion Jones. This is just me speaking my opinion based off of the evidence I've seen. And we'll talk about why I think Deion Jones – the arrow is definitely pointing up for Deion Jones as we get further along. But initially, it's going to sound like I'm taking a dump on Deion Jones, and that's not what I'm trying to say. I think – with Keanu Neal, it is the reason why you got to like this guy. The only reason why I like this guy is because he is, for, you know, all intents and purposes, he's sort of the X factor for the defense. When they have a problem, more often than not, they really do turn to Keanu Neal to solve that problem. And I'll use a couple of examples from last year. Not only is he the guy that's often tasked with covering some of these top tight ends at the Falcons face, and you saw this particularly against, you know, most notably against Gronk in the New England game, where he was very effective at sort of keeping Gronk limited in that game, at least in the instances where him and Gronk were man-to-man. I think Gronk only had one catch on like four or five targets in that game. Almost all of Gronk's other big plays in that game came when he was going against someone else in man coverage. You know, you saw this against the Saints game, in the second Saints game. You know, the first one, Deion Jones knocked Kamara out of the game. So positive Deion Jones there. But in that second Saints game, it was primarily Keanu Neal that was tasked with covering Kamara when he was sort of split out wide and whatnot. And while he didn't shut down Kamara, I think he did more than held his own and did a pretty good job and limited him in a lot of ways. And then early in the season against Buffalo, for example, when the Falcons were using Deion Jones to spy Tyrod Taylor, Jones really struggled, and there was a number of critical third downs that Tyrod was able to extend drives because Jones, you know, was out of position and got juked in the open field and wasn't necessarily making plays in space. And then late in that game, they sort of switched and asked Keanu Neal to basically do that, and Neal did a much, much better job than Jones had done prior to that point. And again, that's not meant to knock Jones, but it is, I think, when the Falcons coaching staff needs a player to sort of handle a tough man-to-man assignment that is going to either erase or contain an opposing team's key playmaker, more often than not, as I said, they turn to Keanu Neal, and more often than not, I feel like Keanu Neal comes away from that assignment, you know, sort of with a mission accomplished banner, you know, that he can hang above his locker. And, you know, someone asked me a couple of weeks ago on a mailbag question on the other podcast I do, Falcon Central Radio. You can find that on profootballcentral.com. And he asked, you know, how I would rank, you know, the five most important players in order on the Falcons currently. And my ranking at the time, if I recall correctly, was Matt Ryan 1, Julio 2, Keanu 3, Grady Jarrett 4, and Alex Mack 5. And, you know, someone broached a similar topic on Twitter the other, you know, a week or so ago. And I basically said, like, the two most important players on the defense are Grady Jarrett and Keanu. And, you know, a lot of people responded, like, you don't think Deion Jones is the most important, or you don't think Deion Jones is up there. And, you know, for the reasons I said that, you know, I think Deion Jones is high. You know, you certainly, if you're ranking at the entire offense, I would say he's in the top 10. I think the lowest you could probably put him is at 9. I don't really think you could put him higher than, like, 7. I don't know if I would put him higher than, like, Devontae. Like, Devontae would probably be 6 for me. Or whoever you think between Alford and Trufant, whoever you think is the better corner. In my case, I think it's Trufant. If you think it's Alford, whatever. We talked about that yesterday. I would probably put that guy maybe 6 or 7 ahead of Deion Jones. So, like, I feel like Deion Jones is probably in the top 7, definitely in the top 10 in terms of importance. But I think because of what I'm talking about, where, you know, having that eraser, and that's more often than not Keanu Neal and not Deion Jones, I don't think you can put him above Keanu Neal. I don't think you can put him above Grady Jarrett, because when we look at the run defense, it's usually Jarrett or Poe or Shelby or Reed or somebody else that's having an impact in those games against the run, and not really Deion Jones. When the Falcons have good games against the run, in reality, outside of those last, the month of December, where Jones was legitimately good against the run in those games. But prior to that, the first 11 games of the season, like, you know, he was, if we're being honest, he was more often a liability than I think he was positively impacting the run defense. And for those reasons, that's why I put a guy like Jarrett up there. But I say all that because I do think Jones has the potential to potentially outrank guys like Jarrett and Neal. And I think this year is going to be the year where we discover whether or not that's true. And I think it goes back to what Deion Jones did in that month of December, or really in January, in that Week 17 game against Carolina. And in that game, because Keanu Neal was tasked with keeping Greg Olsen in check, which he did to superb ability, the Falcons were then forced to ask Deion Jones, now you got to cover Christian McCaffrey. And so whether McCaffrey split out in the slot or whatever in the backfield, it's your job to, you know, basically contain him or erase him. And I think Deion Jones did an outstanding job in that game. In fact, it was, you know, one of the better games, probably the first time he's really done that, if I'm being completely honest, over the course of his career. Because you go back to the Super Bowl, he struggled a little bit with James White. James White had like 700 yards in that game. You go back early in 2017, where Theo Riddick and Ty Montgomery gave him a little bit more than he could potentially handle in some of those early games. And I think a lot of it sort of does come back to the notion of sort of splash plays, where I think because Deion Jones makes a ton of them, as I mentioned, you know, how many interceptions he has, I think he kind of gets a little bit more credit than he often deserves in terms of how important he is to the defense. And I think he's good in coverage. I think he's an excellent coverage linebacker. I don't think you can have as much success as this defense has, you know, playing man coverage as much as we do if he was a liability there. But I don't think he's always quite the kind of coverage linebacker that people assume he is when they see, like, his Pro Football Focus grades in his coverage and whatnot. I don't think, unlike, you know, I think unlike Trufant, Alford, and Neal, he's not really erasing individual players. It's more, you know, those guys are certainly not to the degree that those guys are often tasked with doing. But I do think he has the potential to do so, as he showed in that Week 17 game. And, you know, I'd like to give him credit for stopping Gurley as well in the playoffs, but I do think that was more of a group effort between him, Neal, and Brian Poole to a certain extent. Although, you know, you could maybe say that he did, you know, 50% of the work, and the other guys did, you know, split the other 50% maybe. And I guess this is my point as far as getting back to Keanu Neal. I guess what I would say, the way I would summarize it, is like, however good you think Deion Jones is, whether you think he's an elite linebacker or a pretty good linebacker or whatever, I think Keanu Neal is a notch above that. And I think that's been the case the last 2 years. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to look forward to in 2018 is whether or not that, you know, that changes, and whether or not Deion Jones goes above him. And let's circle back a little bit to what I teased earlier with the pass rush. I'll get there eventually. I'm weaving you a web of knowledge. But, you know, I think where the pass rush matters is going to have significant ramifications in regard to how good this defense can be, as well as whether or not Deion Jones can take that step and be that type of eraser in this defense, where particularly when you look at the schedule the Falcons are facing. They're facing a lot of really good receiving running backs. You look at the early part of the schedule. You got McCaffrey in week two. You got Kamara in week three. Now that Ingram's going to be suspended, you imagine Kamara is going to spend more time in the backfield rather than being split out wide, which means that's going to put more of the responsibility of covering him potentially on Jones rather than Neal. Then you got Gio Bernard. You got Le'Veon Bell. You got Saquon Barkley, right? And that's just in the first half of the season. And, you know, I don't necessarily expect Jones or anybody on this roster, even Neal, going against those five running backs I just named to go 5 for 5 in terms of containing and erasing those guys. But what I would like to see is maybe if Jones is tasked with those responsibilities, that he could go 3 for 5 in those games and really do a good job in at least 60% of those games. And particularly in the games against like Cincinnati and New York and Carolina, where those teams have competent to good tight ends, where Neal is going to be primarily tasked with erasing those guys, you're going to really need Jones to do good jobs against Gio Bernard and Barkley and McCaffrey in those games because it could have a detrimental effect on the rest of the defensive game plan. Not to mention when you go in the second half of the season, you have these good combinations of running backs and tight ends with various teams like Washington has Chris Thompson and Jordan Reed. Cleveland has Duke Johnson and Njoku, right? You got Ronald Jones in Tampa Bay, who we'll face in the early part of the season. But, you know, then you have the tight ends with O.J. Howard and Cam Brate. Green Bay has Ty Montgomery and Jimmy Graham. Not to mention, you got Dallas and Arizona, who got Zeke Elliott and David Johnson later in the season, even if their tight end positions quite aren't, you know, up to par. And so you got to be, you know, whether or not our guys come out on top of some of those matchups or at least hold their own is going to be something that is going to have a significant impact on the outcomes of these games. Now, where I relate this to the pass rush is specifically talking about one hypothetical matchup against the Giants. The Giants have a ton of talent at their skill positions. You can argue they may have more talent at their skill positions than any team in the league, including the Falcons, with Odell, Ingram, Sterling Shepard, and Saquon. Assuming all those guys live up to their potential. You probably, from a matchup standpoint, you probably look at Odell, Trufant being on Odell, Keanu being on Ingram, Alford covering Shepard in the slot, and then Deion Jones being tasked with taking out Saquon. And, you know, you could probably throw Isaiah Oliver in the mix and he can cover Cody Lattimore, whoever the Giants' third wide receiver, which is why yesterday I was like, yeah, you can throw Oliver out in the Giants game as your third corner and be fine. But you need, for those four main matchups, you need the majority of those to go your way. You need, you know, three, if not all four of them. You know, I wouldn't expect all four of them to go your way because, again, there's a give and take with this. And particularly the Odell-Ingram matchups are the most worrisome because Odell Beckham's Odell Beckham, and we've seen him rip through Robert Alford once, and we'll see if he can, you know, if he'll do the same against Trufant. And then athletic tight ends like Ingram are the tight ends that give Keanu Neal the most trouble historically. Basically, Ingram is a 240-pound receiver. Basically, imagine if Mohamed Sanu weighed 30 pounds heavier, but instead of running a 4.7, he ran a 4.4. That's basically Evan Ingram. And so that's going to be a problematic. That may be the toughest matchup that Neal has this entire season. And so I know someone's shouting from the bleacher, what about Devondre? Like, no, get out of here. No, not Devondre. You know, Devondre struggles against in-breaking and out-breaking routes, so a guy like Ingram is not going to be his problem. He doesn't have great hips, which is a relative, you know, compared to what? You know, compared to Evan Ingram, no, he doesn't have great hips. Compared to Paul Warlow, Devondre's hips are amazing. You know, his hips don't lie, as Shakira might say. but Campbell, you know, I think where Campbell sort of shines when he's covering tight ends is really on the vertical seam routes because of his straight line speed and the fact that he doesn't necessarily have to have that sudden burst out of his breaks and due to that length as well. But, you know, the minute the tight end turns, you know, he's going to create that separation. And really, whether or not Campbell gets beat on that play is often determined by whether the quarterback throws with timing and anticipation. And if he throws with time and hits that receiver in stride, then that guy can potentially pull away from Campbell. But if he doesn't, then Campbell's speed allows him to sort of make up for and recover off of that separation that is initially gained out of that initial break. So, no, Campbell against Ingram, no. Get out of here with that nonsense. I do think, you know, Neal is going to have more than his hands full in that game. But you imagine a hypothetical situation where, you know, if Jones is struggling against Saquon in that game, then does the Falcon, do they make a mid-game adjustment and say, okay, well, now put Keanu on on Saquon, and then does that leave them vulnerable against Ingram? And then how do they deal with that? Do they put Ron Parker on him? Do they put Isaiah Oliver on him? Do they put Alford then on Lattimore on the outside? Then they put Poole in the slot? Who knows? But there is the potential trickle-down effect that you have where if Jones can't handle his assignment, you know, then the Falcons have to make all these adjustments. Now, to be fair, the Falcons, and one of the reasons why I love the secondary, is the Falcons have, you know, Ron Parker and Isaiah Oliver, if they are your emergency options, those are pretty good options to have. And so those are way better options than most teams would have in that sort of predicament. So, you know, I don't want to sound doom and gloom like, oh, no, the sky is falling or anything like that. But it is one of those things where it's like, yeah, you have this trickle-down effect because all of a sudden now some of the lesser – you're putting lesser players on better – receivers, and so that can affect your game simply because Jones can't handle Saquon. And you know, hypothetically speaking, you're like, okay, and imagine in this game where Jones is struggling against Saquon, but he gets an interception, and everybody's going to be like, oh man, Deion Jones played amazing because he created this, you know, turnover or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's a positive play, but you know, it doesn't necessarily always balance out if, you know, when he ends one drive because of his ability to create a turnover, but on the second drive, the Giants score because Saquon, you know, converts like two third downs or whatever. And then on the second drive, when the Falcons make the switch to put Keanu on Saquon, then that leaves them vulnerable and Evan Ingram gets a big play down the seam because Ron Parker's out of position or something like that. And so it's like, yeah, did Deion Jones play great? He made some plays. He had definitely ended one drive with a turnover, but then not necessarily directly, but indirectly, sort of allowed two touchdowns because the other matchups didn't work out. Now, again, this is a hypothetical. I'm not blaming Deion Jones before any football has actually been played. But I think it's handy to sort of think about it in those ways, particularly against a team like the Giants, where when you're talking about even with one of the best secondaries in league, even with one of the best back sevens, when you factor in, you know, that the linebackers also cover as well, that if they get overwhelmed at times, it really does put all the emphasis from the pass rush to sort of pick up the slack. And I think when you look at, particularly at this Giants matchup, the one major vulnerability that they have is their offensive line and their quarterback. And, you know, Eli has taken a lot of hits over the years, but every time I've watched film of Eli, he has little to no desire to take any more. And so he can really struggle in terms of his poise from the pocket when you can create pressure on him. And look, I don't blame Eli for that. Yeah, I would be that way after taking one hit from an NFL defensive lineman. Imagine taking 1,000 over the course of the last, you know, 14, 15 years that Eli has. But I think, you know, when you have these matchups, particularly Tack against Solder, Vic against Eric Flowers, Grady Jarrett against whoever on the interior, whether it's Omame or Brett Jones, you know, Jack Crawford against a rookie and Will Hernandez. Looking ahead to this game, you know, here in July, which we'll see when we get there, you know, later this year. But I'm looking at this matchup and I'm like, if the Falcons can't hit Eli at least eight times, you know, however many sacks that creates, three, four, whatever. But if they can't hit Eli at least eight times in this game, they're terrible. Like, I don't know, man. But like, I feel like eight hits is lowballing because Vic alone against Eric Flowers should get at least three or four hits, you know. And so they should just be teeing off on Eli in this game. And that winds up taking a lot of pressure off of the secondary and the back end. Because as I said, you know, the nature of secondary play, and again, I should include linebackers as well, is to get beat. Like, you know, as I said, as I explained on the cornerback breakdown, you know, your average NFL offense in any given game is going to complete, you know, 20, 22, 21 completions per game. And, you know, a good secondary might lower that by one, two, maybe three. But if you really want to affect, you know, and lower that number, take it from, you know, 22 to 19, yeah, a good secondary can do that. If you want to take it from 19 to 16, then you really need your pass rush to really step up and do that. And in reality, you know, people can get mad at the secondary for not necessarily creating turnovers. Pressure helps in that regard. And like I'm sure you've heard it before, where it's like a great pass rush can mask an average secondary more so than a great secondary can mask an average pass rush. And you know, when you look at that, the reason why that makes sense is like if you're creating pressure, the ball has to come out sooner. And so what that allows then is the guys on the back end, they could be a little bit more aggressive and maybe jump some routes, as you saw, you know, Earl Thomas do against the Texans. And because you can rely on that pass rush to get there, and the ball has to come out soon. And so, you know, if the quarterback also has guys in his face or hitting him as he's throwing, all of a sudden that's going to lead to some errant passes. That's going to lead to some ducks, some tip balls over the middle. That's going to create some more opportunities for turnovers as well. So I guess for me, to wrap this thing up, talking about this Falcons defense as we've done over the last couple of weeks when we've done these training camp previews, I think it's all well and good to talk about the potential of this defense, because I agree with you. There is a lot of potential there. But I don't have the questions in the secondary that, you know, seemingly other people might or may have. To me, all the questions are with the front seven, because I feel like the secondary, particularly over the last 2 years, has really gone out there and proven, you know, that they can hold their own against even some of the best competition that they face. It's not to say that they're going to, you know, again, they're not going to race and shut down an entire offense, but it is one of those things where they're going to definitely hold their own. And I think all the question marks really are up front, you know, particularly when you go like week one. Like, I know Keanu Neal's going to have his hand tool against Zach Ertz, but, you know, I think he'll hold his own. You know, I don't know if Devondre Campbell's going to hold his own against Dallas Goedert. I don't know if whoever the Eagles running back in that game, whether it's Jay Ajayi or Sproles or Komet or any one of the 37 running backs that they have in the roster, I don't know if Deion Jones is going to hold his own against that guy. I don't know if Tack is going to make Jason Peters look like an old man that needs to retire. I don't know if Vic Beasley is going to make Lane Johnson go from what is widely considered the best right tackle in the league to, at least on that game, look like a guy that has no business, you know, being a starter in the league. Is Grady Jarrett going to make Brandon Brooks look like an overpaid fat guy, you know, he's capable of? These are the questions I have going into that week one game. And if the answers to those questions are yes, our guys are going to make those guys, expose those guys, then, you know, then the sky really truly is the limit for how good this defense can be. But if the answer is no, then, you know, like, then you're talking about what is at best probably going to be an above average defense, which is fine. When you couple that with a potentially top five or top 10 offense, like we're hoping, that's more than good enough. But if the offense still continues to struggle, you know, like, not to say, again, that's still probably going to be a good enough unit to get to the playoffs. I don't know if that's good enough to make a deep run, but, you know, we'll talk about that come December and January, as opposed to July and August. But I guess for me, like, that's one of the reasons why I still remain a little bit skeptical. It's not that they don't have the talent, this defense. This is certainly not that the pass rushers don't have the talent, as I talked about in the D-line preview and the edge rusher preview. But it's like, you just need to go out and see it. I need to see you. It's all well and good if you're going to beat up on the bad players. If you're going to beat up on Sean Coleman Tack and get three sacks against him, that's awesome. Yeah, that's great. But I want you to do it against Jason Peters. I want you to do it against some of these top-tier left tackles and make those guys look really bad. You know, it's one thing to beat up on the lower levels of competition. Can you play at a high level against quality competition? And I think one of the things that I don't question about the secondary, with few exceptions, is I don't question whether or not those guys can hold their own against quality competition. I still remain skeptical whether or not we're going to consistently see that from these guys in the front seven. So, that's it, guys. I don't have much else to say about the safety position. I think tomorrow we'll be talking Cleveland Browns to wrap up our AFC North series. I think if all the schedule goes according to plan, then we'll finish up with the special teams. And then we can have a Q&A on Friday if you guys are down for that. And if you want to send in your questions now, you can do so on Twitter at FalcFans. Just let me know it's podcast related. If it is podcast related, just go ahead and send those Q&A questions over to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. Of course, you can check us out on Facebook. Send me a message there. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. The email address is lockedonfalcons@mail.com. You can send an email there. And of course, you can leave a comment at lockedonfalcons.com or falcfans.com, where the show is posted daily. So that's it, guys. Until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.